G'day and welcome to the On Podcast, Outwear's podcast all about the mobile industry and mobile tech. We have a very, very exciting show today. It's our first On Podcast featuring a guest. I'm very excited about this. But before we introduce our guest, I want to introduce our Outwear hosts for the week. Myself, Ken Humphreys, the iOS team lead here at Outwear. We have Keith Smythe, our new Android team lead.
Hello.
Last time you're on the show, we jokingly said you were the BlackBerry team lead because you wanted to be the team lead of something.
I've moved up in the world.
And since then, you've become the Android team
lead.
Here
I am. So. If you dream with your BlackBerry, one day you can make it.
Dreams can come true. We also have Danny Gorog, co-founder and director.
You've got iOS dev under my name.
Yeah, well, you know, humble beginnings. I know you're a director, not one of my iOS devs.
Good.
And finally, I'm very happy to welcome Dr. Hugh Bradlow, Telstra's Chief Technology Officer. Welcome, Hugh. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here, actually.
This is great. We haven't had a guest yet, so we're excited to see how this goes. I think you're going to share lots of...
Flattered to be the first.
Interesting. Look at that voice.
I know, it's
beautiful, buttery, deep voice.
Made for a podcast.
I'm not sure how to take that.
No, that's a compliment. That's a compliment. You've got a good radio voice.
So the first
good
question,
face for radio, you mean.
The first question I have for you is, I'm wondering what a CTO does. I've got an image in my mind, and that's basically a big conveyor belt of smartphones and routers and technology and Google Glasses just all coming on a conveyor belt, dumping on your desk. And you have to pick it up and try and test them all, and then the next one drops down. Is that basically it?
No, not quite. In fact, I usually have to beg the device guys to get my next device. No, we look at the sort of upcoming technologies. You know, what's going to be possible? What's the next set of technologies we're going to need to adopt as a company? How will the business evolve because of technology disruption? So I do get to play with a lot of cool things, but they're more in the sort of the form of serious analysis and experimentation than just devices, unfortunately.
Not just toys.
Yeah.
So, an interesting question. What can you say what you're rocking right now? What's your device of choice, your mobile?
I've been an HTC One guy for the last year, so I've now got the M8.
Okay.
It's an awesome phone. It really is. Uh-huh. You know, it's really lightning quick. I've been on Android since it came out, so
yeah, okay.
I'm locked in there.
long time user.
How often do you change your phone?
Actually, I often get another phone and I'll set it up, but it takes me 2 days to set a phone up. That's the one major weakness in Android. You know, on iOS, you can put it on your iTunes and it'll just transfer all the settings and everything. Mm-hmm. I've got about 400 apps on my phone, and setting it up with all the settings and the logins and things takes me about 2 days. Right. So,
but how often do you
change seriously over? Change it once a year, roughly.
Okay.
Okay,
yeah. That's pretty. That's
similar to you.
Similar
to
me.
Yeah.
Similar to you.
You're on par. No, I'm 2 years.
That's about. That's about. You know, it does take. Even with iOS, it takes time. You know, just repairing the Bluetooth devices is such a pain.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You get in the car and it's not working. Oh, yeah.
That's right.
And there's that emotional connection as well. You sort of have to move on from that old piece of metal and form a new relationship.
No, I
don't. No, I don't
at all. I don't have that either.
It's just a phone.
Yeah.
After a year, you hate the phone. You're like, it's so slow and old.
Yeah. You want to throw it out. Okay. Serious, very serious question. This is a hard one. How does a company like Telstra innovate? What is your strategy for keeping up with these little outwear mobile guys?
Yeah, look, first of all, I have to say the one advantage of a big company is we have huge knowledge. So people come at us from all angles. So the way we've tried different forms of innovation, but the way we do it today is we have a sort of fairly broadly based ecosystem. So we have an incubator in Sydney. We have a ventures group that looks for smallish companies to invest in. And we run a crowdsourced innovation system internally at the moment we call the Innovation Hub. It's highly gamified, but basically we're not short of ideas. What we are short of is the ability to get them into market, to invest in them, and to deal with the fact that often they're cannibalizing of our existing revenues. So we have this Innovation Hub, which is all gamified. Anyone in the company can submit ideas. The ideas get filtered. Then my team will act as an enabler and a facilitator to help the ones that get selected to progress, and ultimately they end up hopefully as products and services.
So you're turning that size to an advantage because you're crowdsourcing to the whole staff as opposed to yep. one person trying to dictate.
Yeah.
And who sits on that? Who looks at those requests and forms and says, this is something that we're going to pursue? Is that your team?
Yeah, my team, but we don't do the selection. So we have, we give everyone who signs up for the hub, and that's anyone in the company. I think we've got about 5,000 people signed up. We give them innovation dollars, mm-hmm. and they get, as I said, it's entirely gamified. They choose whether to invest in projects. If a project gets enough investment, it passes to the next threshold. So we do that sort of pre-filtering like that. People will win and lose on the innovation dollars.
So you've got 5,000 people registered on this portal and I get 100 innovation dollars and I can go and have a look at what the people are saying yep. and I can invest my money in an idea.
Yep.
And does it have a time limit?
Yeah. We have what's known as the parking inspector who comes around and says, your idea is done. It's sat there uh-huh. too
right.
long.
Right. Hello. And then do I get my money back?
You lose it. If you Ooh. Invested in something, you lose it.
Okay. So not like Kickstarter, where in Kickstarter, if it doesn't meet its goal, you don't pay.
Well, you get the money back. But yeah. I mean, they're not real.
They're not real. I'm not sure about that with Kickstarter, by the way. I think in theory you do.
If they don't reach their goal, it's only when they reach their goal.
Oh, yeah, reach their goal and they don't produce there, you don't get your money back.
No. If you reach the goal, you've lost your money's gone.
Yep.
If they don't reach the goal, you get your money back.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a really interesting idea, though, around how to kind of vote for innovation. I mean, what we do here is we have, I guess, Gideon, who's our development manager, talks to people who've got innovation ideas, and then we bring that, we sort of filter them up at a director of management level, and we say, this is something that we think we're going to invest in.
Yeah, and it's easy to scale for us because we've got 70 people, so we have that direct
but I really think that's really interesting. I hadn't heard that before about Telstra, and that sounds really innovative, actually,
it
ironically.
Well, innovative.
It's sufficiently innovative that other companies are actually going to buy it as a service from us.
Wow.
But it's like most of, I keep telling my staff there's no such thing as a good idea. There's no such thing as a unique idea. So there are other people who have done similar things, but we think we've now got this quite well-tuned and refined.
And so you've executed it and you built it yourself and you own the IP behind it. And that's great.
So
What are you calling it?
We call it the Innovation Hub.
Hub.
Hub, yeah.
So if one of these ideas does get off the ground, do you have kind of strategies for, like, do you prototype? Do you have proof of concept? Do you have little skunk works offices set up? How do you get an idea off the ground?
So we do all those things. Okay. It depends on the idea and what it requires. So for example, just to give you one example, one of the issues we had with our field staff is in a major disaster like the Queensland floods. We've got people all over the country. You won't know who's where, whether someone needs help. But at the same time, you don't want to be tracking people because of the intrusion in privacy. So we developed a portal which will take our Active Directory. If there's a flood in Queensland, it'll take all the entries from that area, send them an SMS, say click on the link. If they've got a smartphone, which most of them would have, it'll open up an app, and the app will tell us where they are and whether they need help. So they've got a red button or a green button, and the red button says do it. Now, that we knocked up ourselves. We've trialed it. We've actually used it. I don't know if you recall a couple of months ago, someone sent white powder to our building in Exhibition Street. We've used it in that instance to check on everyone.
Wow. And was that difficult to roll out something like that, or was it a matter of months or years?
Well, that one's we're kind of it's that one was process. Trialed with yeah. it's sort of growing, if you see what I mean, as opposed to, so we trialed it, now it's coming out. But that one was relatively easy because it doesn't threaten any product lines.
Yeah, okay.
On the other hand, we've had other ideas which do threaten our current revenue streams, and that's much harder.
Difficult to be able to make that proposition without testing it in the market and seeing that it is the right idea, but then you've already shown your hand. Yeah.
Yep.
Very interesting.
That's an interesting problem for big business in particular. And Apple, I remember Steve Jobs talking about that, the fact that the iPhone cannibalized the iPod, which was a massive business. And you've just seen since the iPhone launched, the iPod line is just basically going down to zero now.
Yeah, it's not quite zero, funny enough.
It's not. I know it is. It's still big, but it was from a big base. But how do you think about that internally? Like, do you try to disrupt your own products and services?
Well, my team does, and a lot of people in the company try and do it, but it's still an active debate, and I wouldn't wish to declare victory on that one. Mm. That's still something that we've got to go through a process to refine.
Do you think there's a difference in... we're a relatively young company, so I'd say that that sort of change in innovation has been baked into our DNA. I mean, we're all very used to changing the way we do things on a regular basis if it's an improvement. And I guess there's kind of... there's a little bit of gusto, you know. I guess there's less of a tail behind us. Do you think, you know, in 20 years' time, that will be just part of companies' DNA, that they will just have to have that innovative change or die sort of mentality, or there's still that big size that will always hang around?
That's an interesting question, Ken. I don't know, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I won't be around in 20 years, so it doesn't matter. But it's if you're a product company, mm-hmm. In other words, you sell products as opposed to selling your time, it's always going to be a challenge.
Yeah.
And any company that's going to be affected by technology is going to be challenged in that way. I don't know anyone who does it really well.
Mm-hmm.
Not anyone.
Yeah.
Perhaps Google do it better than most is my...
They still feel like they have a very strong presence in there.
But they never do anything that threatens search revenue, right? Which That's is 90% true. Of their revenue. So, yeah.
Well, what I thought was really interesting from this week and WWDC was the fact that Apple feel like they're really pulling back on the Google services that are integrated with the OS. And they've been over time peeling those back. So, you know, YouTube was included as a default app on the earlier iPhones. They got rid of that. Google Maps was default app. They got rid of that. Now,
look how that worked out for them.
Well, I actually think in the end it's been okay. Maps is much better integrated into iOS than Google Maps ever was.
Right.
Then there's this week is you know, Bing are now the sort of a search a major search partner within within the app within iOS, mm-hmm. and it sort of slowly feels like they actually own the customer relationship, and Google's position is actually reasonably fragile at that level.
Yep.
So it'll be interesting to see, because that will threaten their and I think mobile is threatening their advertising revenue, because people don't tend to browse as much on mobile.
Google?
Yeah.
Funny enough, Facebook have been doing really well on the mobile. So
But I think they have they come from a different angle and they've baked it in differently.
Yeah. Look, the ARPU on mobile for advertising is definitely much less than on
You can't say ARPU on these podcasts without explaining.
Yeah.
Sorry. Average revenue per user. Sorry. Okay, sorry.
I will be buzzword free.
Yeah, okay.
Or we bust the buzzwords. So there is that difference that Google, you're saying Facebook is...
Facebook's making progress on mobile.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay.
So monetizing.
Yeah. That's sorry.
Monetizing. So it could change. So Danny just mentioned WWDC. We've walked into iOS territory. I'm really interested to know, have you seen the iOS keynote from earlier in the week? I don't know.
I've seen snippets and reports and things. So I wouldn't say I'm 100% across it. But
well, we have done a show specifically dedicated to that, so we don't need to delve into deep things. But I guess, what's your take as an Android user? Do you see that the iOS platform is becoming more appealing? And
well, as an Android user and as a Telstra CTO,
yeah, of course.
Look, as a Telstra CTO, we're neutral, right? Because we serve what customers want. So let's put that aside. Let me talk personally as an Android user. I've stuck with Android for the last X years. What they came out in 2007, and I probably went onto Android in about 2009, somewhere of that order. And I've stuck with them because I met the swipe guys in about 2009, and as soon as I saw it, I realized I was hooked. I actually met them subsequently and said, "You guys are drug dealers," because you know I was completely hooked. And for some reason, iOS have been very slow to introduce swipe. They've just done it.
So swipe again is the keyboard.
Keyboard. Mm-hmm. And once you've if you're not Gen Y and you can spell, it's absolutely addictive. So once you're on it, it's very hard to go back to tapping things. So
just feels old-fashioned.
They've now introduced an iOS 8. But now I've become addicted to Tasker. And it'll be a cold day in hell before you see that on iOS.
What's Tasker?
So Tasker is an app which effectively allows you to program the phone, but you don't have to know syntax. It's like if then
right.
IFTT or whatever it's called.
If this then that.
So it's as I say, it's absolutely addictive. First of all, I can do programming again because I don't have to remember syntax, which always kills me. Mm-hmm. And secondly, there are just all sorts of oddball things that you want. So my wife's a school teacher and she turns her phone on silent when she's at school. So she leaves school, and we can never get hold of her because the phone's on silent in her bag. So I've put Tasker on her phone so that as soon as she gets into the car, it turns her phone up to normal. So it's just little things like that, which, as I say, I found to, already I've got about half a dozen use cases, which just have me hooked.
So. I think as an iOS user, I'm suffering a bit of Stockholm syndrome where we're finally getting features that Android's had for like 3 years. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Yeah. We've got so much freedom. Yeah. Look at all the things we can do. Yeah. And really, we're just playing catch up.
Yeah.
Well, not entirely. So the new thing where you can have effectively what I call simultaneous ringing across your Mac and your iPad and your...
Yeah.
That is cool.
That is pretty cool. Now, I've been able to – I get today – I have a thing on my Android phone which called Push Bullet. So when I'm sitting at my desktop, I actually get my SMSs popped up on the screen. Uh-huh. And I, in theory, could send SMSs from it, but I haven't quite worked it out. I can't do phone calls. I can do it on Viber, of course. But so that is a pretty cool feature. And the thing that Apple do by – taking their time is they get the user experience exactly right.
Yeah.
So is it a user experience that I as a bleeding edge user want? No, but then I go through a whole lot of frustration. Is it a user experience I want to give to my wife other than the feature of turning the sound on? Yes, that's where Apple do well.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, the thing that you have to remember because now they are one of the dominant platforms. When they implement something really simply, it makes, I mean, you know, I've been a Mac user for a long time and it's always been fairly simple to use and we were always a minority, so I don't think it had as big an impact. But now that iOS is, you know, this majority operating system, if they implement a new feature and make it really invisible and simple to use, it catches on in society. Like, you know, yep. iMessage is a thing. I guess Google Hangouts is...
Hangouts
is
kind of
is a thing as well, but I don't think it's quite made it into the, you know, the common vernacular in the same way.
No. But it's always that technology. And, you know, Hangouts is a good example because Hangouts now does SMS as well. Yep. iMessage just blends SMS and IP messaging. It's that integration, which is so hard. It looks easy at the user experience level, but it's all the work behind the scenes.
Yep.
That is so difficult. We're about to release an app, and I'm not going to say what it is. But most, I mean, the UI is beautiful and pretty, but it's all the integration work behind the scenes that the user never sees. Yep. That is where the magic is.
Yep, absolutely.
So, I think with that continuity stuff, Apple's going to have to nail it as well. It's going to have to work all the time because, you know, some of their past releases of iCloud related things. It sounds really great, and then the one time when you really need it, if it doesn't work, you're going to give up on that feature.
Yeah.
So if continuity, if it just works, if I'm on my phone and I switch to my Mac and every time it works, I'll have something.
So that issue of consistency in the whole technology space is absolutely vital. That's why we've put so much effort into our network, because you want it to work when you need it. You never know when that's going to be.
Yeah. And so this is a good little segue into... mobile networks. Do you have any sort of info or intel on where mobile networks are going? You know,
can we have a scoop?
Is there a post 4G that we're already looking towards?
So I'm on the board of a carrier group called Next Generation Mobile Networks.
What do you think they do?
So they're the guys who really went to the... if we let the standards bodies do this, they do it the way the vendors want it. We want to define it the way the customers need it. So we're user experience guys, effectively. So this group did LTE, for example. It said these are the things you need to do in LTE to create the right user experience. We've just kicked off a piece of work on 5G.
There we go.
So if you look at mobile networks, every 10 years, there's been a new G. So analog was 1G in 1980. 2G was GSM voice in 1990. 3G was data in 2000. 4G was LTE in 2010. So everyone's expecting we'll have 5G in 2020. So what is it? And there's a lot of debate around that. A lot of the vendors are doing what I call hero experiments, you know, 10 gigabits per second to a pedestrian if the wind's blowing in the right direction and they're actually carrying an antenna with them and things like that. So that kind of, yes, you want higher speeds, you want more efficiency in bits per hertz, you want lower latency because these things got to really be responsive. But the big thing that's going to change is you want, I call it one network to rule them all. And that is the fact that if you look at the world today, there are lots of different networks. So there's an emergency service network, there's a public cellular network, there are Internet of Things networks, there are different types of radio systems. You want to try and incorporate them into one infrastructure which you can get that economy of scale and scope that you get from a big public infrastructure. And that's what we're working on. So you've really got to be able to scale the network in two directions. The one's in capacity and the other's in terms of number of devices. So, and then on top of that, you want to build in functions like content distribution, being able to do that more efficiently. So mm-hmm. That's the kind of direction.
Do you think there are some cities that are implementing Wi-Fi as like a city-wide solution.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's any chance that, you know, Wi-Fi and mesh networks and things like that are going to creep up before 5G, you know?
Well, on that, before you get to answer that, yeah. Telstra had an announcement just recently, yes, about building out Wi-Fi capability,
yes,
and kind of having a seamless customer experience between a data network, a 4G network, and then the Wi-Fi.
Yep.
So maybe you can answer the...
So I'll answer it by covering what... So the technology to create the seamless customer experience is not quite there yet. There's a thing called Hotspot 2.0, which will allow you to authenticate with your SIM. And then you can use roaming agreements and things so that you can move around the world and just, you know, not have to type in passwords, okay, to authenticated networks. But actually the first phase of what we've just launched is using a roaming technology from a company called Fon. And what it does is, if you're a broadband user, BT do this in the UK, if you're a BT broadband customer, then you can get an app on your phone which, whenever it sees a Fon hotspot or another BT broadband customer, will automatically let you log into their Wi-Fi. And essentially what they do is they share the broadband access and the Wi-Fi access points, and they partition it so that, you know, there's no security issue and also no performance issue, although the latter technology is still immature. So we see Wi-Fi spreading in different ways. And one of the reasons is, it turns out, interestingly enough, the probability of having a cellular modem is directly inversely proportional to the size of the screen. So as we talked about earlier, if you've got a 5-inch device, almost always got a cellular modem in. If you've got an 8-inch device, 20% have a cellular modem in. If you've got a 13-inch device, virtually none of them have a cellular. Hmm. So Wi-Fi is a complementary technology. Now, will it start to supplant cellular?
Yeah.
My estimate is not, but, you know, these things are very hard to judge.
Yeah, who knows what might take seed and sort of catch on. Do you think there's a threshold where things are going to be fast enough? Like, for me, if I have a good LTE connection, I'm pretty happy. Like, the fact that I can watch video on the train, to me, that's kind of... Isn't that good enough?
If you've got a cellular modem in the device.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's why Wi-Fi is complementary. And the other thing is going back to my consistency point, being a unlicensed spectrum, of course, there's no control over the access. Mm-hmm. And I go to a lot of big international conferences and the Wi-Fi is unusable. You know, first of all, you just do a scan and there'll be 200 hotspots within range of you in the hall and none of them are working.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's that capability.
But is 4G fast enough? Yeah. I think the answer is always no, isn't it? Because you always want your download faster.
I think
you always want your better, higher quality video.
I think it's mostly faster than Wi-Fi.
Oh, I mean, 4G is incredible. What, and I don't know if this is publicly available, how much of the customer base is using 4G?
Ours is high. Okay. I can't remember the numbers, to be honest, Danny, but... We didn't do what the Europeans did, which is to charge more for 4G, which was a big mistake, by the way. We saw 4G as an efficiency technology, and it helps spread the load between our 3G and 4G network. So, for example, coverage is always better on 3G because we operate at 850 as opposed to 1800.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you're indoors, you'll probably fall back on 3G.
Mm-hmm.
But 4G takes the load off that 3G network.
Do you get to a point where you unplug... When you get to 5G, you then unplug the 3G network and sort of 5G, 4G?
Well, we're having the conversation about 2G at the moment.
Right.
It's quite hard to do because you've got inbound roamers. And the biggest problem was machine-to-machine or, things like buses with modems in them.
Right.
They go on for 10, 20 years and, you know, you turn them off and they get pretty upset. So you've got to have a transition plan and things like that.
Very interesting.
It's that real-world technology where... when we're dealing in software, we kind of like, yeah, everyone will have the latest phone and they'll get the software on their phone.
Yeah, that's right.
These real devices you've got to support.
Well, I at one stage was responsible for turning off X25. I don't think you guys would even know what that is. It was an ancient cellular, ancient data network technology that the telco industry used, probably before you were born. And you know, it was incredibly hard to migrate the last customers off it because they had to migrate them off it. You had to change their mainframes, you had to change their terminals, you had to change a whole series of things.
Well, look at Windows 90,
XP.
XP.
Yeah.
I mean, people can't get off it. It's like they're stuck.
Yeah.
My dad's still on Windows XP and he's still using Microsoft Works. And I can say that on this, and he's never going to hear it because he's no idea how to listen to these.
Embarrassing. That's very embarrassing.
So where did you come from then?
Yeah, that's right.
No, I meant genetically. Yeah.
I was the black sheep.
So we talked before how you mentioned with as Telstra CTO, you're sort of platform agnostic. You know, iOS and Android full support. Do you have direct relationships with the actual vendors? So do you sort of, you know, work with Samsung, say, to develop a device that's going to be appealing to an Australian audience and things like that, or not? That's not quite how the system works here.
We have minimal influence on people like Samsung who are dealing a global market. So, you know, we're 0.2% of the world's population. So, you know, they're much more interested in the other 99.8. It's also in our interest to leverage global scale. But we do work with all the vendors. We discuss our requirements. We look for opportunities, how we can create new value or differentiation. But it's, you know, in the whole, it's kind of at the margin.
Yeah, okay.
And when a new device comes out, how much testing have you done before it hits the market?
So we have a lab up in Parramatta which does a pretty thorough test of the device. Particularly, this we learned when we introduced when we switched off CDMA and we turned on our 853G network, which is a very bold move. But the we didn't realize that the devices would have such an influence in coverage. Mm. So the guy who was getting a signal on his back paddock in Whoop Whoop suddenly got a new phone and it was the same frequency in the same tower, but he wasn't getting his throughput. So we have to do a lot of device testing, and we have a thing called a blue tick, which says, you know, that the radio performance of the device is up to the standard. Mm.
I think that's something we've dealt with, the fact that these devices can be spec'd the same, but when you actually, you know, even from a software point of view, you
Chuck
the software on and different experience.
Yeah.
This is maybe a question better for Keith to ask, but software updates on Android.
This is my question.
Okay.
I was very interested in, because Android, the whole idea about how the carriers and the OEMs work with new versions of Android, I was very interested in getting sort of from Telstra's point of view, how that works at Telstra. When there's a new version of Android, say KitKat comes out, and then you've got the Samsung, the HTC, Sony, you've got all these different OEMs. How does that work at Telstra? How do you do your testing and get certification?
It's tricky because even though the OEMs don't want to create a lot of customization for the carrier, there's still some customization. You'll notice when our phone fires up, you'll see the Telstra logo.
Yeah,
we have our Telstra app, one app that I think they allow us to go into the phone. But most of the time, it's the OEMs themselves that delay the updates, in my view. But the reason for that is because they're doing it across a wide range of carriers. There are about 800 carriers in the world. So, they're doing it across.
And the larger, like the Sprint and the Verizon, AT&T, all the American carriers get first.
Probably,
But it doesn't seem like they all get updates all the time.
At some point, like the chipset manufacturers say, I'm not going to support this new version anymore. And then their phone is essentially dead to Android. So they're stopped.
That's one of the things I think Apple does very well, certainly in mobile, is the iOS 8 is going to be supported on iPhone 4S and above.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is pretty impressive. And they roll, you know, the stats I had on the screen was pretty impressive, like 89% adoption of iOS 7 versus, you know, under 10% of KitKat.
Which is frustrating because all the cool things are
very,
in KitKat.
It's very interesting. Come on, guys. Although when we look at some of our stats for some of the apps like Snaps and Solve, we find that, you know, over 50% now are on 4+.
Oh, that makes me feel happy.
Yeah.
On four, oh, okay.
Four yeah, plus, yeah, not
ice cream sandwich.
I thought you were talking iPhones for a
moment. No.
But Google are acutely aware of this and will deal with it, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Google I.O.
Well, that's a good segue.
Yeah, perfect. See Hugh, I can segue too. Is there anything that you're expecting or hoping to see out of Google I.O.?
Are you going?
No, one of my team is going, right, who's actually a developer rather than
a manager.
Rather than a Tasker user. And look, there are a whole heap of things that we have seen the speculation about. I have to be a bit careful because I don't want to sound as though I'm giving you inside knowledge, right? as much as I'd like to, I can't. So I'm not doing that. But I think obviously you'll see a watch. There's a lot of speculation.
Well, I've already talked about that.
Yeah. You'll probably see more developments around Chromecast, which is quite an interesting model in many ways, technically very interesting.
It has recently come out in Australia too.
Yeah. It's being sold in Australia. I have one. I haven't actually used it much. My original idea was that I travel around with a Wi-Fi hotspot and I would create my own little network and then do... But most hotels I stay in don't give me enough bandwidth to do that. So those are kind of big things. But I think probably the big things will be around Android. Is there going to be a 4.5 or 5.0? You know, how will they address some of these issues? Because Tim Cook was making a big thing about how few devices are on KitKat. You know, how will they address those types of things? I think you'll see are quite important. They are talking about robots, quite a lot around robots. So
that's true. They did like acquire, like
they bought a couple of robot companies.
Oh, they bought a lot of robot companies.
Specifically,
what was that one called? The one that had the robot that looked like a dog or
Boston Dynamics.
Boston Dynamics, correct. And they've obviously done a lot of stuff around the self-driving cars.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Do you think, though, that we're ready for an autonomous robot to be wandering around?
I'm ready for one at home. Yeah.
I reckon self-driving cars are just an absolute dead cert. It's just a question of time because the statistics around safety are compelling. 90% of road accidents are human error. So, you know, there's something like, I think, 300 people die in Australia per year on the roads, plus then there would probably be 10 times that in serious injuries. So, you know, you can take a burden off the health system to say nothing of the human thing immediately.
But don't you think there's a huge, just that, I don't know the term for it, but like I would be freaked out to get in a car with no one driving it. I mean, that trust factor, to get me to trust a robot to drive me at 100 k's an hour down a freeway, that's a big barrier for me.
Actually, the big thing they're going to do is what's called platooning when these things come in. So you can pack a whole lot more cars into the freeway because we're all locked together effectively by wireless technology.
Like Voltron.
So you'd be going at 100 miles an hour and you'd be 2 inches from the guy in front of you.
Geez.
And I'm excited about the stuff that they talked about with self-driving cars is, you know, most of the time you own a car, it's sitting in a car park doing nothing.
Yeah.
And so the car picks you up when you need to be picked up, it drops you off, and then it goes and picks up the next person, and it's all just kind of scheduled automatically.
Yep.
And that's the future I want to live in.
Yeah, it does.
You know, less cars, less pollution, more efficiency, less time in traffic, less parking hassles. There are so many.
On a train with other people in there.
So many. And when you're driving, you can actually be productive. You know, I see so many people when I'm driving looking down at their lap.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
So did the police.
Yeah, I know, but I haven't seen any police catch anyone. It drives me nuts. Because they're just kind of, you know, up and down. It's just, and the sooner we can actually do stuff and we don't have to think about the road, I think the better.
Yeah, really interesting. You also mentioned wearables, where we're thinking there's a watch coming. Do you see that as, you know, a huge change in the industry, that it's going to turn things on its head? Or
ultimately, yes. Mm-hmm. At the moment, we're in the Gartner hype cycle, which shows you start off with a new technology, gets a massive amount of hype, then it falls into what's called the trough of disappointment. And then it either dies at that point or it works its way out on a sort of steady progression. Right. We're kind of in the trough of disappointment. So it was pretty well summed up to me by my son, who's got one of these wearable fitness devices, who took it off because someone said to him, what does it actually tell him? And the answer was nothing. Mm. Nothing he didn't know anyhow.
Yeah.
So I think you need a category killer in in that area. I know how to design one. I know what I want in it. Sorry, I just don't know how to make it. So I should do a Kickstarter project. Any problems, I couldn't make it. But you need to take a pebble watch, a basis watch, and put those things all together and make one set of features that really compel people.
Where the battery lasts.
And that's
the key thing that we're pushing.
You can see the watch. So I had a basis watch, which is pretty cool because it gives you a continuous heart rate measurement. Uh-huh. One small problem, I couldn't tell the time. So, you know, I do wear a watch. I'm of that generation. I've got my eyesights now that I have to have white hands on black face. So the Pebble will do that for you. It's e-ink. So it's,
Have you got a Pebble?
No, I haven't. Okay. Because in the end, I decided it didn't do anything more than this did other than give me notifications.
I showed you the AFL app for Pebble that we've built. Have I shown
you
that?
Yes, you did show me that.
That's live now.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And Pebble, I don't think we've talked about it on the podcast.
We? Well, we work with Telstra on AFL Live, and we've done a version for Pebble, and it's available on the Pebble App Store. It's a brilliant little app. It gives you footy scores on your wrist. It vibrates when a team kicks a goal. And I used it on Saturday night. I was out for dinner, and a friend of mine barracked for Essendon. He wasn't allowed to go to the game. I said, "Look, don't worry, Diego. Here's my watch. Put it on." We're sitting having dinner, and every couple of minutes, he was like, "Oh, goal."
So wasn't your partner saying to you, "What the hell are you looking at your
watch?" No. I mean, because if it's not that, I put the app, I lean it against the glass, and I'm watching the I'm watching the footy, which is a lot ruder.
It's even worse with a 10-inch tablet in front of
it's
you.
It's a free app, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners have got Pebble. I'm surprised at how many Pebbles I see in the wild. There are quite a few in the office, and you literally get on the train and you see people with Pebble.
They're good.
Pretty
nice
cool.
Devices, yeah. But they just don't do the biometrics, which, I need.
Yeah.
I don't need to
know your pulse. That's what I need it as well. I'll be first in line when they release.
Doug, who was our primary developer working on that, he's a footy fan, and he said, it really does change the way he experiences a football match. So, he feels like it is providing an extra level of value or purpose or something.
Yeah.
So
it's very cool.
It's just, we've just got to wait for the apps and the ecosystem.
Yeah. So, I'm worried that Pebble, I'm worried, like you say, there'll be a category killer and we'll just wipe the face.
So it might be the iWatch. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. Mm, yeah. By the way, that little burst of Morse code is my tasker telling me that one of my family members has SMS'd me. All other messages are silent.
Right.
And so you put that with a Pebble, that would work really well because then I'd be, instead of doing that, I'd be doing this.
Yeah.
We should get you on.
It's coming. is there any other technologies that you can see on the horizon? I guess we've talked about wearables. We've talked about mobile.
Well, what's exciting?
Yeah.
So, I think there's a difference between excitement and world changing, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, give one from each category.
Okay. The exciting are things like wearables, the heads-up displays. I love the Oculus Rift.
Yeah.
And we're going to get the next version, which has got the better resolution because it's a bit too grainy at the moment. Mm-hmm. But the world-changing things are the whole way in which cloud computing is developing. So instead of having IT environments, IT shops and IT service groups, you'll just outsource the whole thing into a cloud service, which is done on a global basis. So that suddenly starts to make IT affordable and flexible and responsive. That's hard to do. And then you couple that with all the big data technologies that are out there, and you start analyzing the data that's flowing in the world. You've suddenly got a whole different way of controlling life. So the example I always give is I drive out of my office in Lonsdale Street every day. I want real-time, instantaneous information of what's the optimal route. I want it to tell me turn left or turn right now. It's got to get me that information within about a tenth of a second. You can do that with that sort of technology. Today, it's very clunky. It's, it'll sort of roughly tell you, it's going to take you this amount of time, but it won't tell you turn left, turn right. It won't give you that instant decision-making. So I think those combinations of the sensors, the IT environment, and the big data are going to change the world dramatically over the next 10 years in ways you just won't believe.
Mm. And will that all be funneled through our phones or our cars or?
A whole heap, just every device everything you can think of. They're all connected devices. Everything is connected.
Mm. I think we had a really interesting conversation about that in the office, about the fact that what does mobile boil down to? What's so exciting about it? And it's the fact that you have this information at your fingertips wherever you are. And that's what we love about mobile. That's what excites us. And yeah, I think that's really cool that the progression, it doesn't matter what device it is.
Yep.
It's still going to have software. There's going to be information, and we need engineers like us to
engineers.
Absolutely, I'm right with you on that one.
And I think that big data thing, it's really interesting that robotic cars or beating the traffic home, all these things, instead of being real world logistic city council sort of problems, not let's build more roads, let's get more data engineers to more efficiently use our roads.
Mm. So now you're on my favorite hobby horse, right? That's brilliant segue, because about 3 years ago, I went to a committee for Melbourne meeting, which is sort of trying to plan Melbourne for 2030. Mm-hmm. So they're projecting a population growth from 3.5 million to 5 million. They're talking about how they've got to build new houses and new developments and new roads and things. And I'm sitting there going, 20 years, that's Moore's Law. That's a thousandfold improvement in technology. We'll have self-driving cars. We'll have telepresence systems. We'll probably need fewer roads in 2030. So I get up and say this, and you can imagine all these road builders sitting in front of me. We're really excited about it.
Took our really, terms.
We've got to get our governments thinking about redirecting the budgets to things that are not roads, because they've got to start planning for this world.
Could not agree with you more. I don't think there's anyone in this business who
I think Melbourne needs more tollways.
Yeah.
More tollways for me to accidentally drive onto and get tolled.
Yeah. It's scary, isn't it, Hugh? Because you don't see that.
No,
you don't see that vision coming out of our government.
No, that's the worry. Actually, it's interesting about the tollway, right? What really makes me mad is when I get on the tollway and the damn traffic's not moving.
Well, now, and you're paying for it.
Exactly. I'm paying the same price as if it's free, if it's clear. So my feeling is, if they'd been sensible, they would have negotiated a deal where you pay inversely proportional to the amount of time you spend between gantries.
That would be nice.
It incentivizes a better service.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's take the pitch. See if we can get this city sorted out with technology. Thank you so much for coming in today, Hugh.
This has been
an excellent conversation.
I hope you have me back.
We'll definitely have you back. With pleasure. Thanks, Danny. Thanks, Keith.
Thank you, Kent.
Thanks to our producer, Kent. I've been wearing two hats today. Danny, do you want to round out with info on how people can contact us on Twitter?
Outware. Our at symbol is Outware.
We should spell Outware more.
Outware.
Yeah, it's obvious to us.
Can they get to us by email? We don't do that. That's not cool.
Yeah.
E-what?
Email?
info@outware.com.au.
Yeah, hit us up.
Great.
Catch you next time.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.